That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
What? That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, y'all. It's this podcast. I asked the question, whose fault is it that you're gay? My name is Eric Williams, and herstory is being made today because this gay ass podcast has had over 250 episodes. It will hit its 5-year anniversary in the new year, and yet I've never interviewed a straight man. Can you believe it, girls? Today, John Marco Cerezzi, a straight man, comes on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. And I do this because he is straight, okay? But the man loves Broadway. He has a limp wrist and is not afraid to show his hairy tits. So please enjoy as we have our first straight guy on this gay ass pod. Cross your fingers, I survive. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is making herstory because while we have only interviewed queer people or straight girlies beloved by the queers, John Marco Cerezzi is the first ever straight man to come on this Gay Ass Podcast. Do you understand how big of a deal this is?
I'm flattered to break the glass floor, or however we want to phrase it. But it's an honor.
Well, I hope you have your knee pads on because you are about to be deep-throating some very girthy questions. And the first question is, John Marco, do you remember how we met?
Yes. I mean, I hope this is correct. A clown bar.
The hit off.
Cool venue.
Very cool venue. I was telling producer Nathaniel about the show before you logged on. For anybody who doesn't know, what would you say is the box most famous for?
Very erotic variety shows that start late, that starts at like one and goes to five. And it's
did you ever go to those like 1 a.m. shows?
Yeah, there was some night that they organized for Clown Bar, and it was I should have been on cocaine or recently tried it for the first time, ketamine, because by 3 in the morning, I was like, get me out of here. It was so late. But my favorite story from it is there was a performer where the act was that they were fisting themselves and they couldn't get it all the way first time. So they shook their hand out second time. And I thought, oh, maybe this is a bit. Here goes the third. Couldn't quite get it. And we all just kind of like, well, they got a lot in there. That's impressive, I guess. But that's, you know, that's, I imagine, their version of cracking on the high note or falling out of the
turn. Sure, it's not getting the full fist inside. But you have to commend them for trying to loosen up the joints, because sometimes you have to breathe into the fist. I am intrigued by your experience with ketamine because it's funny. I've just turned 36 and I've realized that I have not done many a drug at all. And ketamine was one of those that I thought, as a gay guy, I feel like I should at least try it. And I never have. What was your review?
Well, it was, funnily enough, on Fire Island. I was with my friend Jay Jordan. And so we were with like an older, rich gay man's house. So when he had the ketamine and said that it was tested, I go, oh, this is probably safe. That's the only reason, because right. I get so scared about all the things. But he seemed like he had the money to make sure this was good, and he did some first, so it was fine. I would do it if it was right for the mood. It's very quick. It's kind of a little bit of a drunk and a high, and it hits fast, it goes away fast, and it's just kind of like a little bit floaty, but I was still able to talk articulately, so it was fun. I'm glad I tried it.
Did it change your horniness level at all?
No, I didn't really feel more horny. Probably like my guard was down if someone was trying to flirt with me, but my girlfriend was there to keep me in check.
Did she do ketamine, or are we not allowed to talk about her drug experience?
I would just say it'd be surprising if she didn't give it a try. But she it was one of those, it doesn't seem to, she knocked it over with her nose, so I don't think really any got in. So I think she tried.
Yeah.
But she,
I just, yeah. it
The drug culture to me is, it's so, like, I don't know, we're living in an era where there's just so much more information. And so I feel like we are able to take more steps to decide if we want to take drugs or not. And it's like, now that I'm my own parent, uh-huh. in a way, I'm like, you know what? I think it's actually okay if I try it. I just like you, have to make sure it's the exact right scenario,
mm-hmm.
tested with the strips. And
well,
then
I got a chart. I was with another guy. He gave me a chart on my phone that shows drug interactions, because I think what I always do is I go like, well, I had a mimosa this morning. Can I have K at night? And this drug thing was like, yeah, it's okay. Or don't do this. And so as I've gotten older, I never did drugs when I was at the age that I should have. And now that right. I'm past my mid-30s, I'm like, okay, let's get it in while you still can.
Well, it's funny, when we met, you and I are both now, I guess, very similar age, because we did Clown Bar, which, for anybody who doesn't know, which is everyone, that was a show that was produced by Pipeline Theater Company, which was born out of the acting school I went to at NYU. And all these great people are a part of the theater company. But this show was like a clown mafia show. And Gianmarco and I were both like, what, understudies mm-hmm. in the on like swings of the show. And you understudied the star, the main part. And I was, you know, the fucking bitsy ass characters. But I remember at this time, you were like pounding the pavement as an actor. You were spending a ton of money taking one-on-one classes
so
with casting
money.
Directors and agents.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would normally drag you for it, but baby, you booked a giant GE commercial.
I did.
And then you now are sitting here in front of me as a very successful stand-up comedian. So would you say spending all of your dad's money at one-on-one was worth it?
I don't know. I was such, I mean, it's a brutal industry. It's terrible. And one-on-one, people would get upset about it, because it was like, you pour your money into this thing. You meet with the casting directors. Maybe they call you in. You're not paying to audition, but yes, you are. And they would have stories of people who saw them and then were brought in for this. And that would make you go, ooh, there's a chance. So I wish when I had moved to New York, I had focused more on cultivating a community than just trying to get in with casting directors, because I got so little out of it. I ultimately did go, oh, commercials are where the responses are. That's where the opportunities are. Not anymore, by the way. My God, that vanished. But in the beginning, commercials, was especially before I joined SAG, I made so much money, and I just acted a lot more. Even if they were terrible projects,
same.
I acted in Investigation Discovery. That is the new Law & Order. Like people, the old trope is everyone in New York's been on Law & Order. Not anymore. I'd kill to be on Law & Order. Now it's
Murders at the Museum.
Murders at the Museum, Over My Dead Body, Stalked, Recreation, where you're doing like stories that people would win an Oscar for. They're so dramatic, and you're doing it in one take with no stunt supervisor, and they air. I was recognized from that in Ireland once, and I was like, I got paid $50 to be in Stalked. And
well, that's the thing, is you said you made money doing commercials. I did a bunch of non-union commercials before the pandemic, and I had a full page in Vogue magazine. I was on a Times
right,
Square
I remember
billboard.
What was
Zelle.
The product again? I remember it.
Zelle,
yes.
When Bank of America came up with Zelle to like send money. And I thought I had made it. And then I got the check. And can you just give me your guess as to how much I was paid to do? It was on billboards in every major city in the country, full pages in magazines. It ran on TV and social media. How much did I make non-union?
I'm thinking $500 for the shoot day, $250 buyout for the billboard in perpetuity. So I'm saying $2,500?
I think I made either exactly $2,500 or like $2,250.
Crazy.
Isn't that crazy? Because when you, I just saw the Amy Poehler, Regina Hall clip of like Regina saying, I did a McDonald's commercial. And Amy goes, well, did you make a lot of money? That could have made you a lot of money. And Regina was like, yeah, I made $40,000. And then cut to me with this fucking story, $2,000.
Yeah, it was a bad time. And now a lot of the union stuff with the internet usage rates, it's gone down too. And I got very lucky. I was in this GE commercial. It was a series. They did two rounds. But the real money because they don't air commercials the same way they used to. Back in the day, I'd get $1 million right. bucks from it. But I got to do live appearances. And that was at the time, crazy money, where they flew me to Las Vegas to the GE shareholders conference. I show up. I have a hammer because I was in the commercial. And they'd pay me $15,000 for the day. And I was like...
Holy shit.
I really made the mistake. I spent a lot of it filming a sketch series. And I thought,
Matzah pizza.
And I thought, you know, okay, it's only up from here. And it was the most I made as an actor, hands down.
Hey, y'all, mid-episode interruption by your girl. I just want to tell you that I'm doing my show in LA on October 23rd, which is very, very soon. It is my solo show called Why All the Drama, which talks about me going from a nice Jewish boy to a gay Jewish slut. It is an hour of gay-ass stand-up storytelling and a bit of Broadway. So please come and see me at the Elysian October 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are in the description. I love you so much. And now keep on enjoying the gorgeous Gianmarco. Bye. Love you.
Okay.
Well, I truly am going to get into some like silly, horny, theatery questions, but I do want to quickly butter your biscuit and say that you have always hustled. And I have always looked up to the fact that you are like, know that you belong in the industry. You just had to figure out where it is.
Yes.
And you would not take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what we as loud Jews need to do.
Yes.
Just loud people, but we're
yes,
we have
the Jews. The Jews need to be more pushy. That's the lesson you should take away.
More pushy and more represented in Hollywood, I would say personally. Now, Gianmarco, we have always aligned on the fact that we're both theater kids. Mm. You got a bachelor's in fine arts at the University of Miami in musical theater. I too studied theater in college, but I want to ask from a straight man's perspective, you grew up wanting to do theater, but what does a straight man aspire to be? I wanted to be Sutton Foster as a young closeted kid. What did you want to be, like Hunter?
To a degree, I was definitely singing Hunter in Little Shop of Horrors and You're in Town, no doubt. I loved Hunter. I mean, when I was like in high school, it was like Adam Pascal. I wanted to be cool and rock and roll. And if anyone had said to me, you're more of an Anthony Rapp, I would have been like, how dare you? I'm the cool rock and roll guy. But I do get that feeling of when I listen to women sing, whether it be like a Sutton Foster, like if I'm hearing Gimme Gimme, I am imagining some mix of first person, third person, and I'm performing it. Not even necessarily as a woman, but I'm performing it at that key, singing.
You can feel where in your mask the belting note is coming from, and you can feel the vibrato coming from you, even if you're not wearing the character heels.
Yes. If I could sing that, if I could sing like that, oh, I'd be a menace.
Well, inevitably, you're going to get cast in some Broadway show. You're going to have Liz, whatever her name is, as the vocal coach. And you are going to be belting higher than you've ever belted
before.
We'll
see. I'm taking voice lessons again because I have this new show thing I do called Theater Adult where I sing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the reason I stopped musical theater is I wasn't a gifted singer, and I ran into walls, and I you know, a little OCD. I'd get so neurotic about the high notes, and I wanted to be a tenor, and it was torture. I mean, I quit singing before I quit acting, you know, to a degree, and now I'm returning to both, being like, I'm remembering my limitations. I don't want to fall on my ass in front of a sold out crowd. So
Well, we came up during the pinnacle of Broadway was like Book of Mormon. Mm. And you have to sing a crazy, crazy note every other second in that show. And I think that for people like us who are baritoners.
What a torturous term. The thing you want to be is part of your name.
It's really devastating. But I too quit. I quit singing in musical theater.
You got further though. You were. You should have seen my callback for Buddy the Elf. You got there. You had a lead in a musical.
I did see. That's the thing is I finished that show being like, I did it and I can't wait for my Broadway career. And then I did not book a single job for like 9 months.
But you have to hit a G in that big closing. What's the big number? What's this big happy number?
World's greatest.
There's a G in that, right?
There's a G, which I get this. I had to audition and hit that G every time. But then when I did the show, they're like, oh yeah, we can move it down a full step. And so it was an F.
Oh, an F. I'll hold an F.
It was an F.
I can do an F.
I know.
Any day.
The only problem is they make you sprint the entire song and then hold that F, and that makes it a little less
fun. I think that's really cool, though. I think that's really, and I don't know how it would fit in my life again, but like to really done a full lead and danced, I mean, that's very cool. That's very cool.
You know what? I appreciate you say that because my friends around me always just make fun of me when it comes up because it was my entire personality when it happened. And how could it not be? But I'm also like crazy OCD. This is the most embarrassing story, but it really mirrors your experience of just like being so in your head about your voice. During the tech rehearsals, I had just been in 3 weeks of rehearsals in New York. They flew us to North Dakota to do a full week of, you know, crazy long days. It was my first time doing a lead in any show, yeah, really, at this level. And during a rehearsal, I get a hug in the scene and the actor accidentally hit my like throat.
No.
Like accidentally like bumped my throat. And instead of me being a normal person, which is just like, you got bumped, take a breath, do a little vocal check, you're good. I started to spiral that I was ruined. And then as I'm spiraling, I remember I go to the choreographer. I was like, I just got hit in the throat. Do you think I'm okay? And she was like, yeah, you're fine. And I'm like, okay, I go onto stage. Eric, we need you on stage to do a group number. And I start to have a panic attack. And I then start to feel tears come on. I run off the stage through the auditorium like I'm in fucking High School Musical 12. I then get to the lobby and the fucking director and the choreographer had to watch me weep having a panic attack about my throat and my voice.
Wow.
And of course it was completely fine. It was completely fine.
I can relate to that 100%. I wonder if anyone's destroyed their voice just from a misplaced hug before, but I get it. I get it. The stress of it.
It's so much stress and so much pressure. And I think that when you talk about like wanting to build community instead of going for the casting director agent classes, I felt the same way. I felt like we were given no tools in our BFA programs to actually build a career. And so we were just sort of like, you know, taking swings and doing what we thought we should do to build a career. Now it feels really great to kind of have our own hands on our own paths. But speaking of paths, it would not be a gay ass podcast, John Marco, if I did not ask you the question I ask our straights, which is, when it comes to the gays in your life, who was your first? We love John Marco, but John Marco also loves the gays. So who was it?
I do. And I think the first that really comes to mind was I went to a private middle school that I wouldn't call it like it was once a Christian school back in the day, but it had loosened up. And it's kind of shocking given today's political climate, but we had one of the fifth grade homeroom teachers. I think he was homeroom for fifth grade and sixth grade, was named Mr. Breyer, and he was gay, and he was openly gay, and I don't think he was married, but he definitely, like, he was the fun. Looking back, he was probably like 25, who knows, but you know, when I was a kid, he was an adult, and he was like the cool teacher. He was the one you wanted for math, you wanted for history. And two things I remember, there was one time like I was dancing before class, just being a trying to get attention. And he said, "Jamarco, I date men, but that's the gayest thing I've ever seen." And it was like, it was this, and I remember not even, at least the way we talked about it at this school, it wasn't even mean. It was funny. I wasn't like upset by it. It was just, it was amusing. And I think, who knows if he thought I was a young gay kid and I'd come out of the closet someday, but he definitely like talked to me in a way that was blunt and funny. And he did an assembly once, because the teachers would do assemblies, and he did a very kind of surprisingly moving one where he talked about being a wrestling fan. And no one in his life liked wrestling, but then he went to a professional wrestling match and to be surrounded by people who liked wrestling, how cool it was. And I found out through the grapevine, I think my mom, where she was like, oh yeah, some of the parents were upset by the assembly because it was a metaphor for him being gay. And I was so dumb. I was like, oh, I thought it was just about wrestling. But I guess it was some version of him explaining like what it was to feel isolated as a gay person. And so I look back and I had this incredibly, not even progressive, but just people being open about who they were in a way that I feel like it definitely informed my views or made it seem so much more normal than I think from some people at that time era of just having a gay adult who's your teacher.
Well, that I think that's a big reason why gay rights was able to get more attention was because more gay people were just being visible. Yeah. And I think it's the whole thing about ignorance of like the reason why so many people are fighting trans people right now is just because they don't know any. And now they're just painting all these crazy pictures. But you had a Mr. Breyer who was making it not only normal, but just like actually not a big deal at all.
Yeah.
And so I want to shout out.
Mr. Breyer was great.
Do you think he must be seeing all your stuff now.
He's definitely written me a couple times because I use his name in jokes now and then just as a teacher. And it was weird in middle school. I went through this phase because certainly when I was in middle school, there was no students who were like gay or openly gay. And I went through a strange phase where I don't really know what it was, where my version of being the class clown was I would be like flirty with like guys in a way that the intended reaction was for them to be like, stop it. Ugh. But I would go to a guy and be like, hey, big fella. And I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was some like I was worried people would see me as feminine. So I was like, I'm going to lean into it in a comical way to almost deflect. But I don't remember that being a calculation. But I had this very conservative band teacher named Dr. Lewis, and you know, doctor of saxophone.
Sure.
And I would do this thing where like if there were dances, I would go up to the guy and be, hey, save me a dance, Kevin. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was. But I went to Dr. Lewis and I was like, hey, Dr. Lewis, save a dance for me. And that night, it was a Friday. I was at my dad's house and the phone rang after the dance. It's like 10 p.m. And I picked it up and it was Dr. Lewis. And he said, is your father there? And I was like, oh no. And I gave the phone to my father. I think Dr. Lewis was like, it was incredibly inappropriate that your son asked me to a dance. And my dad told him to go fuck himself because he's got his own, which yes, at the time I appreciated, but my dad's crazy. And then when I got to school the next week, Dr. Lewis was my advisor. We were past homeroom teachers. And the principal or someone like took me aside and said, hey, you don't have to go to this advisor. You're not in trouble. But clearly, clearly it upset Dr. Lewis in some way. And
Jesus Christ.
And so, you know, in a way, I got some experiences of of being the only gay kid in school. Without ever being gay. that was, and then I went to a very progressive high school where there were open, way more open teachers.
Where
I was fucking the teachers. And I was lucky. I had it around me from a young age.
Well, it seems to be that you, even though your parents, you talk about your parents being crazy and about the early divorce and all that, I do like give your dad props in that moment to say, go fuck yourself on the phone, because Dr. Lewis was clearly grappling with his own internalized either homophobia or just outright homophobia or like whatever the fuck that
or
doctor
the only
saxophone.
Thing I'll say in his favor, which definitely I do believe that, I imagine if you're an adult, when a kid tells you like, hey, you want to dance, you're like, are you out of your fucking mind? You want to all I know is this. It's like if I was a teacher, if I was an adult and a 12-year-old started being like, hey, come down. I'd be like, get away from me. This has nothing to do with homophobia. I'm just, I don't, this is a lot.
Yeah. You say, come on, Chuck, get out of here and go get some punch.
I think
punch.
That's what you that's, do.
I think that's what you say. You say, go get some punch. You don't go to Chuck's father. I found it. It's like, no. You found something within that troubled you, and you should talk about that with someone that's not the child's father.
Yes, I agree with that.
But you do seem to be someone who is allowed yourself to take up space, which maybe it's because of the straight white manness of it all. But I want to ask, because this new special, which I need to congratulate you on, Thief of Joy, is so divine and it deserves every ounce of praise it's gotten. But how has it been exploding in this way? And I use the word exploding very lightly because I know you've been hustling for all of these years. But with the social media of it all blowing up, with the special doing so well, what has it been like to get recognized now that you are out? Did you feel prepped for that when it happened? Or was there like a growing pain phase where you felt either an imposter syndrome or like you didn't deserve? How does a neurotic Jew deal with fame?
It definitely, it was gradual. So I got a little bit of like we had a joke thing with my girlfriend where it'd be like, oh, someone recognizes me. She would keep like a little tally in her phone. And it was like, ooh, I got recognized twice today. And then it got to a point where I was like, it's not fun anymore. I've had recently, I think it was like, I had a gradual, which is good. Thank God. And then the way social media works is then it's exponential. And suddenly I got to a place where I would be in stressful situations and getting recognized and you go, oh, I see why people go crazy. I had like a friend was going through something really bad and they're telling me this horrible thing and I'm trying to be there for them as people are going like, hi, how are you? A big fan of your work. And you're like trying to silently be like, thank you. My friend, his whole family just killed themselves. And it's like, it's definitely surreal. There's moments where I'm stressed. I have a temper and I don't yell at people per se, but like if the train is, it doesn't come or whatever, I go like, fuck, like I scream it to the sky. And there's been once or twice that I do that. And then someone goes, oh my God, are you a comedian? And I've said, no, and I walk away. So
that's self-preservation, babe.
Self-preservation. I definitely got to a place where like I don't really do meet and greet stuff after the show because it just got to be too much. So I'm navigating it. I think I haven't really felt the imposter syndrome only because I felt the gradualness of I go to Raleigh, North Carolina, or Raleigh, wherever you say it, for the first time ever, and oh, 10 people came who knew me. Cool. And then the next year, it's like 50. And I felt the gradual nature of that. So I've grown more accustomed to it. I think the part that feels crazy is when you fly in somewhere, I'm in a bad mood, I'm stressed, I'm thinking about other things, and you go and 600 people are there to see you loosely talk about some new jokes. And you're like, oh, did I con everyone in being here? Am I going to give them enough of a show? And, you know, haven't gotten complaints yet, but that's the weird part where you're doing your second show of the day. You're feeling like shit. Something happened online and all you want to do is be on Twitter doom scrolling and you're still doing an hour of material and you're like, I don't feel in my body. I hope they're getting the show that they wanted.
You know, not to bring up Buddy the Elf again, but the amount of times that I would be like, oh my God, I have to put on green tights and an orange wig and scream sparkle, jolly, twinkle, jingly. And I just had a giant fight with my boyfriend.
Yes.
Like that.
It's brutal. Like, the fights before shows are brutal. And I would say to my girlfriend, I'd be like, baby, we cannot get into an argument like right before a show. But then the problem is, you perform every night. And so what you're essentially saying to your partner is, hey,
we can
no disagreements past five. And that doesn't work.
Well, let me tell you, speaking of having a partner, because you have it extra special because your partner, Tova, is a very successful manager who works in the industry. So I can only imagine the balance you need. I'm not going to sugarcoat it here. I've been with Matt for 12 years, and a lot of our couples therapy in the past year was me and him trying to figure out how we can find balance with me talking about it, because I obsess about it. How could he, there's no way to be in this industry without being obsessive. But how do I balance being present with him, me vying for his support and validation? I had to do a lot of work to realize that the validation had to come from myself instead of him, which was my own mommy and daddy issues. And so I've talked about a lot of like dark times recently, but I haven't been too specific. And a big part of it is my own self-esteem and validation that I've had to get from myself. And only in the past literal few weeks to months have I had these epiphanies of like, no matter what happens in my career, I'm not going to feel better. No matter what Matt says, I'm not going to feel better. And it's like a huge mind fuck for me, because I do have the imposter syndrome and I do have the demons of like, you know, being told I was too gay and too blah, 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 blah. And so like, I can only imagine what it is for you in balancing that with Tova.
It's brutal. I mean, stand-up is so, and I've gotten better, but then things get more stressful. And it's like, I used to joke, Tova would watch me do a set, and it's like how stressful it is for her knowing that however that set goes is going to determine what kind of mood I'm in for the rest of the night. And now she's my manager. She's been my manager for a little bit over a month. And that adds a whole new layer that we're exploring. You know, we have couples counseling too. And it's like, thank God, because now there's this nuance of like, I do the Tonight Show and I want to feel like, you know, I want it to be my day, my celebration. Now, Tova, she also got me the Tonight Show. So it's an accomplishment for her. It's an accomplishment that we share, but I'm used to, or I want in specific moments to be king of the world. I'm the most important person there, mixed with she's been working all day and wants to feel validated for the work that she's done. And we've been navigating, you know, we have two text chains now, and we're like, this one's personal, this one's business. But it feels very natural in a lot of ways, because she was always my creative feedback. I call her my muse, but she's also, you know, an editor and just a lot of things. You know, it makes sense us working together, but at the same time, she doesn't want to get swallowed up by it. I have to have my own lines. I have to say to myself, oh, that little bit of insecurity, I don't need to ask, am I funny though? Like I gotta, and I've gotten better, but it's, you know, it's an endless well of need. And it's tough.
I was just thinking
the thing that your parents can't, the way that you can never replace your parents is like any relationship, you have to give and take. Sometimes with parents, they can give and your existence is what they get back. You know, you're their offspring. Just you succeeding brings a pride and a feeling of joy that no one else is going to take. Someone else, you need to give them more. A parent is one of those few relationships that like your existence feeds the relationship. So it can be imbalanced. And as you get older, you might have to readjust. But a partner is always going to need a balance. And it will never be that pure, it's just different. You'll never recreate it.
Oh, I've been asking Matt subconsciously to parent me for a very long time. And again, I've recently realized that I need to parent myself. The therapist said something that really resonated with me. I have to be my own like kindergarten teacher, firm, but really warm and encouraging.
That's nice.
And that does not have to be Matt. That does not have to be anything. That doesn't have to be like cocaine or ketamine. That's my own work inside. But I
Hey, gay ass girlies. I just read a romance horror book that I think you'd be absolutely obsessed with. Listen to this. It's called House of Rain by New York Times bestselling author Harley LaRue. And at first I was nervous it would be too scary, but y'all, it's scary and horny. And as a newly self-identified slut, I feel seen. Also, it takes place on a remote island in the Pacific Northwest, which I think the Pacific Northwest canonically has the hottest people. So if that doesn't make you squirt, babe, I don't know what will. Also, the book has so many gay-ass themes. I'm talking family drama, there's rumors, manipulation, and again, it's horny as hell. Now, the writing is also so good that it moves real fast, and there's kink in it, and you will not be able to put this down. Harley LaRue is a queer writer who gets it. You can find House of Rain by Harley LaRue wherever books are sold, in print and an ebook. The gorgeous deluxe hardcover first printing is only available for a limited time, so grab yours before they are gone, babe.
I think it makes so much sense that you and Tova are doing the work to keep it in perspective, because that's why you've been able to grow this career. Yeah. It's because you've like kept yourself in check. And speaking of your career, I think it would be against my gay religion to ask you about your Hustlers co-star J-Lo. Gianmarco, J-Lo is vying for another Oscar in Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Do you think your previous on-screen colleague is going to get the statuette?
Well, listen, I have to support it because I would love to have one line in Kiss of the Spider-Woman as well. I played Man in Glasses in Hustlers, and I think he could fit into the world of Kiss of the Spider-Woman. I do think it's one of those things where musical theater is its own art form, and like just visiting it, like it's worked before. Chicago was good, but it's tough. I'm a little feeling cooled off because I did, while on acid, though not enough, watch J-Lo's what was the long music video movie she made? This Is Me Now.
I didn't watch it.
It was pretty. It was the most expensive disaster I think I've ever seen in my life. And
what was that backstage interview of some actress being like, why am I here?
Yeah, it was just one of those things where you go, as an artist, all you want is to have everyone say yes to what you know, I want to do this. Yes, I want it to cost this. Sure. And you see that without restrictions, every artist fails. Every artist, whether it's Megalopolis and Francis Ford Coppola or J-Lo's music video, like there is something about confines that allow you to frame the work better. And that was a just brutal.
Well, you know what I'm nervous about is the Wicked sequel, The Wicked Part 2 for Good, has two new songs in it. And I don't want to brag too much, but I did go to the filming last night of Wicked One Wonderful Night last night. They shot a special to celebrate the new movie coming out, and it's basically Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande performing a bunch of songs, Bowen Yang, Ethan Slater's there, Marissa Bodie, who plays Nessa, Jeff
Goldblum.
Goldblum, yeah. Plays the,
I like how you pointed to me
piano.
like you, Jeff Goldblum, you know.
Jeff, I have this weird thing with Jeff Goldblum where I'm always like, am I saying his name wrong? No, it's Jeff. It's just spelled differently. They did not sing the new songs last night, and I am very worried that Stephen Schwartz.
No, you're right.
Is going to fuck it up for these new songs.
It's true. It's just like, when has a new song in a movie that was classic, like, when has the new song been like, oh wow, this should have been in the original?
I mean, Wicked's been on Broadway for how many years?
Forever. 20, over 20. I mean, it had the 20th anniversary.
Over 20 years, and now we're getting new songs. I'm just very
And you
nervous.
you know that the new song was, it wasn't like, okay, how does this add to the script? It was like, Ariana could sing this as a pop version. This could break into the top 20. And It's not going to be good. I'm nervous. I was so shocked as to how much I liked the first movie. I went into it with low expectations. I thought it was great. I don't think this second act, I don't think it has enough bangers to see it through. I don't think the new songs are going to be good. And I think it's like, at least in the musical, that's where the world starts breaking apart. And it's still good enough. I saw it live recently. I had a friend who was playing Anessa. Yeah, she was in it for a year. Natalie Ortega. She was great. But I'm nervous about this movie. And they're going to try to beef it up with these two new songs. And didn't Cynthia Erivo say she like helped with one?
Oh, I think she did. I think she did.
And I was like, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. Not one bit.
Well, that's the crazy thing about artistry, I think, is that certain people have certain skills. And I think Cynthia Erivo is by far one of our best performers when it comes to interpreting a song in terms of like the athleticism of being able to sing. Do I think that she is like a comedy performer?
Sure.
Do I like when she hosted the Tonys, were the best parts of her launching a punchline? It wasn't. The best parts were her belting her tits off, and God bless. Is she a songwriter? It's yet to be foretold. And I hope that the second movie also really impresses us, because the first was
delish. It's tough. Those Broadway performers, I want to talk to more of them about, like, because there's so many tried to get a singing career, like, you know, a full, and I'm trying to think, were there any that were like truly successful? Because it's just one of those things where
it's been a while.
Listen, I'm a stand-up comedian at my heart. They're going to try to put me in movies. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But stand-up is where I'm like, this is my bag. This is my lane. And unfortunately, with musical theater, I think it's a rough and tumble life to just do musicals for your whole life. They've done it. You know, Patty's been doing it. Audra's been doing it. But I'm sure that pop career looks a little like, ooh, some real money. Ooh, but it's hard. Just because you're good at musicals doesn't mean you can do the pop thing, for the same reason that I wouldn't necessarily want to see Sabrina Carpenter in as Glinda, you know?
Well, it's way more tried and true, I think, to go from Broadway to TV and film, because Audra was on, what, The Good Fight?
The Good Fight,
And so she made her bag from that. Patty's done a million things. So, like, but I do think the pop of it all, like, what, Bette Midler back in the day was able to have some big songs. Babs, of course, huge. But besides, like, I don't see, like, Ariana DeBose becoming a charter.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't see that for her. I just going to take a quick right turn, because I wanted to make sure to ask about your big hairy tits, if that's
sure.
Okay. I've known you for many years, and you've always been a tall, hot, hairy man, but the tits came in recently. Was your decision to work out based on, oh, more people follow me, and so I want them to just look at something more delicious and meaty? Was it I have the money to have a trainer? Was it Jay Jordan just taking you, beating you up in an alley? Why did you decide to get tits?
I think I always wanted to be in shape, of course. And I was so unathletic and so uninspired to work out and uncoordinated. And then in college, I did P90X. And then when I was in New York, I would like do moves at Planet Fitness. And I would, you know, my arms got really good, but everything else was, you know, you got to have at least I needed a trainer to be like, let's bend those knees a little. Let's do some bench press a little.
Sure.
So like I could do the arm moves, sure, though. Those were easy. And yeah, I think like 3 years ago, I got a trainer. I was always doing yoga and spin, but finally getting a trainer just helped focus me on, honestly, sometimes doing easier workouts, but like more focused. And then I started intermittent fasting, which changed my life. And I'm a big...
Tell me more.
I was in Australia. I've always eaten like quote unquote healthy, but sometimes like my girlfriend would be like, you know, eating 100 almonds is actually worse than if you had one slice of cake. And I was like, what? I never looked at calories. I never thought about it. I was just like, almonds are healthy. They're unsalted too. And I never ate dessert, but I just ate a lot. And then I was in Australia, and I had a tour manager, sort of, and he was taking me out to these dinners every night, and they were incredible restaurants. I was in Australia for the first time, and I was like, I want to pig out. I don't want to think. I want to drink. And so I was just, I knew about intermittent fasting. It seemed impossible, but I was like, I want these meals. I don't want to come back from this trip feeling like, oh, fuck. Now I'm like, I put on a bunch of weight. So I started 8-hour window of eating, 16 hours off. I'm pretty religious about it. I try to break it once a week for my own sanity. But now,
what does that mean then? You eat dinner and then you don't eat before dinner?
No, I basically eat. I start, like, let's say I have my first meal at noon, and then I have my last meal. I'm done before 8. So it's just 8 hours on, and then I don't, because I was a big snacker. I was a big grazer, and I would just constantly be eating nuts or carrots or whatever. And it lets me, especially when I travel, I'm on the road so fucking much, and one of the few joys I can have is just eating nice meals. So I can kind of eat more or less whatever I want within that window. I take it off otherwise, and then I break it once a week if I want to get drunk. And it really transformed. Like, I've always gradually been more and more in shape, but that transformed my body. And then, yeah, you know, of course it helps to be in an industry where if I'm wearing a tank top, there's a lot of comments, and surely some people are coming out just because I'm getting in better shape. And I go, fine, it's a little more reinforcement, feels nice. And yeah, it feels sustainable for now.
Well, I'm asking because I myself am newly on a get tit journey, and I think that you are an inspiration, and I want to try to show as much skin as you've been showing.
It's fun
on stage.
It's fun. You listen, when you have a Fire Island date and you're gonna be next to Jay Jordan in a Speedo, you lock in. You go, no more lattes, black coffee for the next couple weeks.
Yeah, well, it's paying off. And I think since we only have a few minutes left, I want to do a few quick fire questions that our gay listeners, which I'll just say our listeners, would like to know about. Gianmarco Cerezzi, you wear a Fosse shirt in your special Thief of Joy. What is the gayest musical that you love?
Falsettos, and it's my favorite musical. It's my favorite musical.
Which is very gay. Not only is it about queer love, but also AIDS.
It is. It is. And I think in a weird way, I relate to Marvin and his narcissism. There's something about wanting it all. I mean, that's a song. I want it all. And I listened to it at a pivotal time in my life. I think it's very Jewish in a way that I wasn't even raised. But I think, like, my mom, you know, culturally Jewish, and something about that musical resonated, the complaining, the negativity, the bickering. And it just, like, man, I love that show so goddamn much. It's deep in my subconscious.
I love that show too. I got to see the revival, 10 out of 10. But you brought up the word narcissist. Do you ever worry that you're a narcissist?
Oh, I know I'm a narcissist. And I think it's just important to, like, ask yourself, okay, how do I balance this? This is my tendency. I try to catch myself in conversation. Oh, I'm only talking about myself, especially as you, like, you get busy with work stuff. You could talk about this happened and that happened.
You got a lot to
share.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And you gotta. So I try to work on that, because in this industry, I'll talk with someone more narcissistic than me, and I go, this was a tough chat. So I gotta not be this someday.
I think it's a bit controversial for narcissist is a word that is so weaponized lately, and I feel like it is a bit controversial for someone to say I am one and I just keep it in check. I think that's pretty
profound. To acknowledge your tendencies, certainly.
Because I'm a chatty Cathy too. I've never gone as far to say that I'm a narcissist, but do you know who would say that about me? My husband. He hasn't. To his credit, hasn't.
Nice.
But if I were to ask him, he would go, That's what he would do.
Mm-hmm. We got to watch it. We got to know who we are.
Oh, and I really do try, but I think you are a reminder from the universe to ask about someone else a question. Okay, who do you think is gayer, Christian Borle or Hugh Jackman?
I mean, I think Hugh Jackman, simply in that he has male lovers, so I'm told. I haven't
heard any confirmations or otherwise.
I've heard enough that I go, I haven't heard anything about Christian Borle. In fact, Christian Borle, didn't he he cheated on his wife with another woman.
He cheated on Sutton Foster with Laura Bell Bundy.
Yeah, yeah. But certainly the fact
so
that
you're right.
That she went from him to Hugh might share a thread. I know there were musical theater camps. This happened twice to me, where there was like a girl I had a crush on, and I competed with another guy. We both liked her, and she liked us both. And both times, both those guys are now fully homosexual. And so I go, whatever woman is attracted to certain aspects of me, you know, it's on the line. It's on the line.
It's on the line.
We clearly have traits in common, and it's happened twice. And I want to go back in time and be like, "Hey, brother, could you have let me have this one? Like, come on, what are you competing with me? You don't want this."
Well, that brings my final quickfire before we do the actual last podcast question. It would be not okay for me to not ask about butt stuff. Finger or tongue in the hole? What's your political opinion?
This is to me, someone to me.
To you, being done
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, a finger for sure. I can't, I have yet to get over the feeling of like, oh, you don't have to do that. It's nice for sure, the sensation. But I think I'm still overwhelmed with the feeling of like, oh, that's so sweet of you to offer, but like, I don't want to make you do that. I think if I was paying for a service and I felt like, yeah, you earned that $20. Great. Or more. I tip if that's all they were charging. But
you'll tip 20% on the $20.
But I think, yeah.
No, that makes sense.
Finger,
your
people like,
pleasing gets in the way of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Finger, I go like, okay, and I'll... We can kiss
whilst I ride your knuckle. Well, listen, John Marco, it has been a goddamn treat interviewing my first straight guy on
I'm
this
so
podcast.
Honored. I feel flattered. So thank you.
It's my absolute pleasure. And I want to round out this gay ass podcast interview with our final question, which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress. Who would you save?
Julianne Moore. Right away. My dad had a lot of like ex-girlfriends, ex-wives, and I just feel like Julianne, like all of them, I could see her playing each one of them. that's the play just for me. It would be Julianne Moore recreating all the former stepmom figures in my life.
Is it because all of your stepmoms had a certain like vulnerability, but also like harshness to them?
Yes.
I think Julianne Moore is a perfect answer. And she's one of the few character actresses that has given us so many, many, many great films, but has a lot more left in her career. I think she is only starting.
She's a Meryl Streep of our time. I once read something about it was some actor just being like, not that it wasn't taking any points away from Meryl Streep, but it was about the way that like it she had been seen as like the greatest actress of all time, and it was like, no, there's a lot. It's just kind of like a thing of like, this is the greatest, and Julianne Moore is certainly one of the legends of our time.
Did you see May December a couple years ago?
Oh, of course. It was astounding.
Oh my God. Astounding. And I mean, talk about like a mother fest of Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. I think that, and also just Julianne Moore has been in so many movies that have like, I don't know, queer undertones, and there's a reason why the gays listening are going to love you for that answer more than they even love you now. John Marco Cerezi, congratulations on the new special. For anybody who hasn't yet seen it, it is streaming on YouTube. It's gotten rave reviews. It's linked in the description. But besides that, can you tell our listeners where to follow you and anything else you would like for them to know?
Yes, I'm touring all around North America for this year. You can find all the dates on my social media. It's at John Marco Cerezi. And I have a podcast called The Downside, where I have guests on to complain about their lives. So check it out.
And by the way, John Marco's co-host on that podcast is the insanely talented Russell Daniels, who I got to see in Ginger Twinsies, yes, and Titanic, and I haven't really met him, but Gianmarco, tell him I'm a huge fan, and I'm a huge fan of both of yours, and that podcast is great.
Another straight guy. We're both straight guys that have, you know, we are thankful for being in our spaces. Russell has played many a woman on off Broadway.
Gianmarco, stay straight, but also a little bit gay, and God bless you.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for joining me on That's a Gay Ass Podcast with our first ever straight guy guest. I also want to thank Gianmarco for letting me grill him with all my gay ass questions. And tell me, be honest, did you like having a straight guy on the pod? I might make that the new thing. Interview straight guys and make them uncomfortable with gay ass questions. But if you want to be comfortable yourself and a little horny, go to Substack for this week's bonus episode with Paul Schwenson. You probably follow him on TikTok or Instagram. He's a gorgeous blondie Broadway baby who played Fiero in the Wicked Tour. He was in Book of Mormon on Broadway. And he talks about meeting his civilian boyfriend while on tour. That is at substack.com/@EricWills. And you'll see a lot more bonus episodes there. And watch me go live from time to time. Oh, before I forget, I'm doing my solo show at the Elysian in LA on October 23rd, which is very soon. So please get your tickets, and I hope to see you there. Stay gay, my friends. I love you.
Bye.
You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and follow the Instagram at Gay Ass Podcast. For more gay assery, the real girlies are over on Substack, where you get bonus episodes every single week and live chats with me and other gay ass guests. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.